Blog Talk Radio.
Your host, welcome to another program. I have to apologize. We had originally scheduled the program to be Saturday, and I was going to try to do it on Sunday, but it just got backed up. My guest tonight was having bandwidth problems, broadband. But that being said, we're here. We're looking good. And welcome to the program. So, and by the way, we are regularly on Saturday in the morning, so you can keep dialing in at that time, and I will be producing the program and broadcasting and then making it available always on Saturday. We're into the week right now, and that's very unusual, but I definitely want to let you know we do one program a week. And sometimes we have to pre-record because we're talking to people that are in real distant, I mean, like 7-8 hour time, distant time zones. Excuse me. So anyhow, lots going on. If you have had a chance to check out the Facebook page, there is some new posts that I put up there. And I, as most of you know, my whole focus for many years was the Maya, still is, and the civilizations, the pre-Diluvian or early native civilizations of Central America, Mexico specifically. And I keep finding amazing photographs and people send me photographs of places like Mount Albán in Oaxaca, Mexico. I'm planning a trip there this summer, and I'm going to document it quite heavily. This is a place that has so many anomalous features that I'm just blown away that more people don't recognize it as a pre-Diluvian, a very ancient place. Much older than what anthropologists will tell us, 25 to 3,000 years old. I'm of a mind, just looking at the architecture and the structural engineering, that the place is probably significantly older by many thousands of years. But if you take a look at this photograph I published, it's called A Short Article on Mount Albán, Oaxaca, Mexico. I wrote an article called The Lost History of Our World. And it's a short article. I only think it's 250 words. But it relates to a standing stone or a stele, which to my mind is continual proof that a technology was in place before written history or the previous civilizations. And this photograph is of an individual not only wearing a helmet, he's wearing a helmet that looks like zero gravity. He has a full bodysuit on, and below him is some kind of propulsion system that would lift him up. And For those of you who are not familiar with Oaxaca, Mount Albán in Oaxaca, Mount Albán is a fascinating place that has these enclosed temples. They're outdoor temples, but when I say enclosed, and I can't wait to get there and really take some photographs and do some geomagnetic readings to see what kind of energy is there. But these enclosures look like they were created to house some form of equipment. My guess is probably some kind of rocket equipment or a flying craft. And when you look at these enclosures, they call them Structure 1. The most famous is Structure 5. And if you look at the photograph, I posted an aerial view of Mount Albán. You can see to the right are these, they're like liftoff stations. It's just so amazing. You see Structure 5 is the closest to us on the right side, and then on the left side is more temples. And in the middle are two landing, what probably were landing strips at one time. But Structure 5 is unique because you have to climb, you have to walk up a set of stairs and walk down into this this open area, which is a chamber that is pivoted down into a central area. Now, most archaeologists would look at that and go, well, that's just the way it was designed and it was for ceremony. Well, why are, the other thing is, this thing is beautifully engineered. Why would they go through all the trouble of having beveled sides that lead into a central area where it looks like something was placed, like a maybe some kind of support structure for the base of a rocket or a plane or some kind of a vertical a blast off or a takeoff structure. It has everything earmarked for some kind of a liftoff arena. And there's like three of these on the right side, and then there's some very, very interesting smaller liftoff stations that are on around the perimeter. So anyhow, take a look at that. I wrote a small article because we're continually learning, not from orthodox science, because they're kind of overeducated and they don't have the bandwidth to stretch their thinking or even use electromagnetic sensing or magnometers or sensing devices to see if there's something going on here, if there's what I believe, which is a natural occurring electromagnetic, or as our friend John Burke likes to say, telluric energy fields emanating from these various areas. So take a look at that and have a look and see what you think. And I think you'll agree that there's something definitely up with that place. I want to bring on Holly Almberg here in a second. I did had a talk with her the other day, and she has discovered some more ruins at the Atacama Desert area of northern Chile. We had Holly on a few weeks ago, and she described her discovery, a unique discovery of an unknown culture in the Atacama Desert, which she has amply called the Nuevo Albergues, after her own name, New Albergues. So I want to play a short tape from her describing what she has discovered. It's quite fascinating, and it has to do with some satellite imagery she just uncovered a few days ago. So let's have a quick listen to that, and then we'll get into our main program for the day.
So we have Holly Almberg on the phone here. She discovered the, as she coined it, Nuevo Albergues, which is in the Atacama Desert in I think it's northern Chile.
Yes.
And so I understand you have some updates for us. Why don't you tell us about your some of your new discoveries, Holly?
Okay. Since we talked last time, I have discovered about 4 different villages. About 3 of them are way up high on mountaintops, reminiscence of Machu Picchu.
Oh, okay. They're very high, very high elevation.
Very high. And one of these things is very high, 1,000 feet above the valley. But why the people built there, we don't know. It is, by now, of course, there are no trees left up there, and all you can see is basic outlines of the foundations.
Mm-hmm.
And one reason that I thought that maybe the people had to leave overnight, on the way up to the mountain village, there's signs of big earthquake movement.
Ah.
They must have possibly moved to the road, and the people couldn't get down anymore, so they had to leave, or whatever happened. They had to get out there fast, because there was no way to get back up again.
And how far away is this, these mountains?
It's about 25 miles away from Nuevo Albergue.
And how high up do you say you think it is?
Maybe 3,000 feet up and thereabouts.
Okay,
yeah, go ahead.
Is Albergue on sea level or above?
No, Albergue is maybe 1,000 feet, 1,500 feet.
Okay.
Basically, it's on the bottom end of a canyon.
Bottom end, okay. Okay,
yeah.
Good. All right, so what else? What else did you find? That's pretty interesting.
Okay.
Yeah.
Next to this village up in the clouds, about 3 miles away, I looked at it on satellite, and there's another village on the high, high mountain again. What caught my eye was this village is built or around red rocks, similar like Sedona, but very, very, very red. And then again, village way up high, no water that I can see of, no way source of. How did they get water up there? And the village of Red Rock really stuck in my eyes, and they have photos of it on the current display. This is very amazing that the people that many years ago had built or choose to build a village way up high like that. Did they find soils or red rocks? Something must have been there that to make them go up there and build it.
Hmm.
So
fascinating.
This is about only 2 miles away from the other village that I talked to before, that the earthquakes displaced the road. So this is 2 villages within 2 miles, and I'm in the valley below. There is now a up-to-date village of about 50,000 people. That you can see that I have pictures of that village, and in the picture I can see on the horizon this high up red village that I call.
That's interesting. So
what is there we don't know. The latest thing is I found out that Google Earth has a feature called Street View. Now, I use Street View in other places, in Germany and other places, but somebody has read our reports about this area. And they sent a car on back roads with a camera.
Are you kidding me? They actually have pictures of this area?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
I just found it about 3 days ago. And in one area, you can see the village and the pictures that I took along with some of the camera car. And I correlated it with satellite views I have of the village.
Amazing.
And you can suddenly see what it actually looks like.
Oh,
except
my God.
That's amazing. So you have a satellite view, then the latest thing is the street view on the same place.
Can you send me those photographs so I can post them on our
I already have to cut some of them in today's yesterday's Albergues.
Okay, so is it on your Facebook page?
It's on there right now. Yes.
Is it on Earth Ancients or is it on the
Albergues?
Albergues. Okay. Well, I'll put a link up for people to look at that.
Yes.
Because if we have ground views of this ruin, that would be amazing.
That's absolutely fantastic. Now, the village that I have, the Red Village. Oh, something like that is not available because there's no roads going to that village right now. So this the street view is not able to get. Are you there?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Where I found the street view is going is some highways that I have that listed. I'll list it. And shown on Google Earth.
I have it right here. It's, let's see. We have to think this is what you wrote, and we'll definitely have a link on our Facebook page. You say, we have to thank the people at Google Earth for the technology that lets us see the streets in far-off lands. And this is places near Nuevo Albergues, street view and the cameras. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
This is amazing. These roads are not like our highways. They're just dirt tracks that the people have in years.
Now, do you think those artificial levels are man-made? They look like they are. Yeah.
They are.
Oh, my God.
I think the old terraces, the whole area and that basically... that I have been there in Chile. All terraces are in mountains, and they go up the mountains up to 13,000 feet.
Wow.
By now, of course, nothing growing there anymore.
Yeah.
No trees, nothing. But you still see the stone walls that they built those terraces off.
Wow, fantastic. Well, that is big news to see that.
Yeah.
And,
I think you have to... thank you to the Google Earth people because they sent the car with the cameras. Somebody's reading our articles.
I don't know if it's a car or a jeep or a tank.
Whatever, yeah, most things. But on top of that, I've seen them in a picture. They have a little, about 10 feet off the ground on top of the camera. You can see the camera all around. You see 360 degrees around side, and then they go up and down. So it's amazing what the technology can do.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, that was a great report from Holly. I appreciate that, and we will definitely keep abreast and look forward to hearing more from you in the near future. Well, thank you for that. And
welcome.
Very good. Okay, we'll talk to you again.
So I'm going to post those photographs. This new series of photographs is quite revealing because it shows massive retaining walls that were created out of solid rock for what appears to be agriculture, but they're the most unified series of retaining walls that I've ever seen. And Holly sent me just a few to post because she wants to put them on her own website and send them to some archaeologists who are planning a trip later in the year. I believe in either the late spring, May, or early summer. But she will keep reporting on that, and I'll give you as much information as I can. It's quite an interesting place, the Atacama Desert, known as Nuevo Albergues. So stay tuned, and in the next day or so, I will post that to the website, which is Earth Ancients on Facebook. Now, our guest today is Bob Curran, and Bob is a prolific writer, but I interviewed Bob a couple of days ago. He's in Dublin, actually above Dublin, and in Ireland, and he did some fantastic research a couple of years ago and wrote a book called Lost Lands and Forgotten Realms. And the reason that this book is quite unique is he takes Schliemann's philosophy, who studied Heinrich Schliemann is the researcher, not an academic, he's just a researcher who studied Greek fables and found the land known as Troy. And Bob discusses a number of other discoveries that have been made by researching and understanding fables and myths. And I wanted to interview Bob and get his insight on places like El Dorado, which is in America, the Garden of Eden, Avalon, and just so many other places that some explorers believe are actual places. So this is the interview I did with Bob Curran. I will come back with you. This is a very detailed interview, and I think you'll like it.
So my guest today is author Bob Curran, who has written a book called Lost Lands, Forgotten Realms, Sunken Continents, Vanished Cities, and the Kingdoms That History Misplaced. Welcome to the program, Bob.
It's great to be here, Cliff. Lovely to talk to you.
You're in Dublin, Ireland. What's the weather like right now?
I'm not in Dublin, Ireland. I am on the other, up at the very north of Ireland.
Okay.
I am about 7 miles from the Giant's Causeway, if you've ever heard of the Giant's Causeway.
Oh, yeah, okay.
I am 7 miles, and we are up on the very north tip of Ireland.
Okay.
You ask what the weather's like? It is sleeting, snowing, and generally cold, Cliff.
Okay.
I wish I was in Southern California.
Well, hey, are you a higher elevation than Dublin? Is that why your weather is a little cooler?
Yes, we are.
Okay.
We are. We are heading towards Iceland, so we get all the snow and stuff that comes in from Iceland.
Interesting. Okay, so it's cold there.
It is cold. You wouldn't like it. You're sitting in the sun, Cliff.
Well, I'm here in the San Francisco Bay Area, and it's nice today. But like I told you earlier in our conversation, I would appreciate some more rain.
Yeah. Well, I used to live in San Francisco. I lived in a place called Russian Hill, if you know where that is.
Sure. Sure.
But this is long ago when I had my hair down to my shoulders.
Oh, you're talking about the hippie period.
I was there in 69.
Wow.
And if you were in San Francisco, if you can remember being in San Francisco in 69, you were never there.
I was down on the peninsula, down in called Redwood City, actually, at that time.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. Well, you have a... You have a memory of this area, then. That's great.
Yes, I do.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about this interesting book. Now,
okay.
It's very, you've done a tremendous amount of research, and you start the book by discussing the myths and the legends. In particular, you you discuss Schliemann's following the Greek folk tale of Troy and actually uncovering it. So you actually give us some foundation. But tell us, what was the great interest to write a complete book about all these myths and legends of forgotten worlds and realms and continents and things like that? What was the interest in that?
Well, you see, Cliff, in every myth and in every legend, and I believe this, there is a grain of truth. Now, we look at ancient civilizations, and there have been ancient civilizations, and we wonder what they were like. Ancient civilizations, or maybe our own aspirations. So what does, the question for me is, what do all these lands and belief in all these lands tell us about ourselves? I started off the book by saying, if you were standing on the shore and you were down on the peninsula or whatever you were, and you're looking out to sea and you're looking at the horizon and you say, I wonder what lies beyond that. Have you ever been, Cliff, down a road and you saw another road heading off and you say, I wonder what's down there?
Of course, yeah.
So yeah. There is a natural curiosity about ourselves. Now, we hear stories of ancient civilizations, of lost lands, of vanished peoples. We wonder what they were like, but we begin to wonder, are they like ourselves? Are they somehow related in a way that we can understand? Or are they completely different from us? So there is that imperative to look at that, to look at the ancient civilizations perhaps as a golden era. We look at our the world around us and say, were they better than us? Did they know more than us? Have we forgotten things which they knew? Or is this a wonderful place? Our world is so full of warfare, full of disease, full of people being nasty to each other, things like that. Is there some place, let's say it's Shangri-La, or when I was growing up, Tibet was a mysterious place, full of great peace and wonderful things. So is there some place in the world where there is peace, wonderful things, and which is far better than the life that we enjoy today? So I think it tells us about what our aspirations for the world and our aspirations for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. But do you believe, which if you look at the Hindu Vedas and Yugas, that mankind has been on the earth millions of years. Was your take in this book that there was previous civilizations that because of a catastrophic event, were wiped out, or through their own hand were blown up in wars and things like that? Is that kind of the foundation, the premise?
Well, that's what I meant, Clive, when I said there were ancient civilizations. Which, yes, I think there probably were. And I think there were civilizations as well, which we know nothing about at this point in time. I think there have been peoples who have risen and disappeared again. They either by natural cataclysm, or as you say, by their own hand, or perhaps they have been wiped out. Now, in the 1800s, in the late 1800s, a French explorer in Cambodia walked out of the jungle and found himself in the main street of an ancient city which had been overwhelmed by the jungle. That was the city of Angkor Wat, built by the Khmers. who vanished about the mid-1500s. There was another city set back. These were cities of temples built by the Khmer kings. A massive building program, irrigated, and with canals and rivers, and the Khmers simply vanished. Now, before that, we had very little knowledge of the Khmers. They were almost like a mythical race, as far as we were concerned. But here is literal proof about it. Once again, you have the legend of, as you mentioned at the start of the program, the legend of Troy. Troy was regarded very much as a Greek myth. So, and the civilization which existed there was simply fictitious. Now we know that it's true. So, in answer to your question, Cliff, yes, I think there have been civilizations which have come and gone in the past. There may have been some sort of prehistoric sets of civilizations which we literally at this moment know nothing about, but which may assert themselves later on in the fullness of time.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I have to ask you this before we jump into the book. Is it your feeling that current orthodox science, being anthropology and archaeology, paint our ancient history correctly? As an example, I've had on my program a number of researchers who show evidence that off the Bimini Islands in the Bahamas, there's
yep.
evidence of ruins very, very similar to the pyramid complexes that the Maya built. And they're, because there's limited funding, they can't get down there yet, but they're planning to. But do you believe that we have been provided with an accurate history of our planet?
It depends. For a long period of time, we consider, and to some extent we still do, consider ourselves to be at the epitome of civilization. We have advanced along the road, and we are much better than our ancestors were. And I think that up until recently, let's say within the last 40 or 50 years, that was a sort of viewpoint which archaeologists and anthropologists had. These people were interesting, but they were only interesting in that they showed how superior we were. Now we're beginning to look at as you say, the structures of Bimini, other structures as well. I mentioned the Khmers. The Khmers had a massive irrigation system, which was well in advance of the dams of the even of the 1700s and 1800s. So we are beginning to look with a fresh eye at the civilizations which have gone before, and perhaps they can point the way and tell us more about ourselves and where we should be going, rather than taking this almost superior attitude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just curious because I'm continually working and talking with people that make interesting discoveries, and the orthodox world just kind of poo-poos everything. And it's going to be left, as Schliemann found, to the so-called amateurs to discover the ancient past, it seems.
Well, yeah, you look, Cliff, at, we are talking about computers. We look at ourselves as a computer civilization, and we have iPads and what. Now, the ancient Greeks had computers. In the early 1900s, Greek fishermen brought up what was called the Antikythera mechanism off the coast of the island of Antikythera off Greece. And that was an ancient computer which they think may have been designed by somebody like Pythagoras. Now, that traced the movement of the stars and the sun and was useful for military purposes, that you could knew when to attack, that you could knew when to defend, things like that. So the ancient Babylonians had batteries, and batteries have been on Earth. So we're not as superior as we think. Ancient peoples can teach us more about ourselves and our civilization than you would think.
Interesting. Let's talk about this wonderful book that you've written.
Okay.
You actually talk and give quite a bit of information about the Garden of Eden, and apparently a number of people have tried to locate the place in different parts of the world. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you find of the Garden of Eden?
Well, it depends. You asked me, Cliff, and I've been asked by several people, do you think these places have existed? My response is, do they exist for you? The Garden of Eden is a great Christian myth. And if it exists for you, then it exists. Because the Garden of Eden and things like the Isle of Avalon, which I talk about, may have existed, or they may, and I have to be very careful because there are people who believe that they did exist, and I am not out to say you're completely wrong. They may have existed, or something like them have existed in the past, or they may be simply myth. I think perhaps they come from Babylonian myth. But even so, even if they didn't exist as a physical entity, then they tell us a bit about ourselves and what we would like to aspire to. Now, they give a notion of the creation and how man came about. They answer a fundamental question: where did mankind come from? Did they come from one source? They could be have been in Sumeria. They could have been in come from Babylonia. And these myths tell us about where we came from, and they answer that fundamental question: where did we come from as a species? As well as that, they tell us about the things that we would like, because the Garden of Eden seems to have been a wonderful place. It may well have been not a garden. It may have well have been, because I came across references to ancient Babylonian texts which said, which described not a garden, but a hunting area. So this is where God did his hunting. Another text, it may have been an enclosed area. Was it a garden? Was it surrounded by a wall? People are beginning to look and try to explain where we came from in terms that we can understand. We came out of a garden. We came out of a hunting area. We came out of a large parkland, if you like. So we are looking back to our sort of source, if you like, and beginning to put that into physical terms, and in terms which we can understand, and in terms which we can pass on to our fellows and to our children.
Mm-hmm. But isn't the Garden of Eden what you would consider a pre-flood myth, something that was handed down? Of course, it's in the Bible to a degree, and it's in other myths, but isn't it something that is very, very ancient? And so,
it is, yeah. Yes. It is. As I say, there is reference to it from very early Babylonian myths, but I suspect, and you're quite right, Clive, it may have come from almost pre the flood. Now, the flood as you know, appears in practically every mythology that I have come across. And you ask what existed before the flood. There must have been something existing before the flood, because the flood was supposed to have cleansed the world and helped the world to start anew. So there must have been something there, which the post-civilization flood, the post-flood civilization actually replaced. So this could be a myth which comes down from an ancient time. And but once again, we come back to the fundamental question: where did we come from as a species? Was there a certain place that we originated from? And that basically, because everybody lives in a place, so the question is, where was the original place? And that answers the question.
Fascinating. You brought up Avalon, and Avalon's been a fascination of mine. And in your book, I discovered something that was quite unique. It's a Celtic theme, but it has its traditions in Greek lore or folklore. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what you discovered about Avalon?
Many people know Avalon through the Arthurian mythology. Now, for those of you who don't know who or what the Arthurian mythology is, that is connected to King Arthur, and it is Celtic. It largely comes from places like Wales and stuff like that. There are notions among ancient peoples. You remember that when I spoke earlier, I said if you were standing on the shore and looked out across the sea and looked to the horizon, you would say, I wonder what lies beyond that. And so there are Greek notions, there are Celtic notions, and there were Roman notions of what lay on the other side, perhaps another island. It literally means the island of Avalon literally means the island of apples, and it may well have been a Celtic myth. It may well have been a Greek myth, but it was a place where there was goodness, and where great heroes went to whenever they left this life and went somewhere else. So we are looking at an isle of the blessed, an isle of heroes, whether they be Greek, whether they be Celtic, whether they be Roman. The notion of Avalon also became entwined with the Celtic notion of High Brasil. Now, High Brasil was a wonderful island in which Brasil, the king of the world, lived. And when early explorers arrived in your part of the world, in South America, they believed they had arrived in High Brasil and named the country after it, and you have Brazil today.
Mm-hmm. But High Brazil is thought of as a sunken land, isn't it?
Yes and no.
Or is because it considered a lost, maybe a lost land is what I
guess. If I can go back into my own Celtic mythology, traveling along the North Antrim coast here, there are supposed to be various islands which appear from time to time. Brazil, High Brazil only appeared it was certainly a sunken land, but it only appeared every 7 years, and you could sometimes land on it. So you had wonderful islands which appeared and disappeared. Now, I travel along the coast, and you see cloud formations. And for instance, in the late 1800s, just down the coast from where I am, a castle was supposed to have appeared in the middle of the sea, sat on an island, which drew people from miles around to come and have a look at it, and then it disappeared again. So you have notions of lands appearing and disappearing. High Brazil was one of those, as was Avalon.
Huh.
And whenever Arthur was carried off by Morgan Le Fay, who was said to be the ruler of High Brazil, or sorry, of Avalon, the island had appeared in order to receive Arthur.
Now, would you say that there's a possibility of, other dimensions or something where if you have hundreds or thousands of people seeing an island,
yep,
and it's being documented and you're actually reading these documents and make, here's this information's in your book, is it possible or have you theorized...
Well,
hypothesize that this could be some form of dimensional work or dimensional.
sorry about that. I'm suffering from the cold at the minute, Cliff. The notion of dimensions, one of the things which, and this is me personally speaking, these things can exist, but only when you have discounted everything else. For instance, this castle, which appeared at Port Stewart in the late 1800s, and which people came and had a look at, may well have been some sort of optical phenomenon. They were looking at a castle somewhere else, and it was reflected by some way, which we don't understand, onto the Donegal headland. One of the things which you can look at is you can say, yes, this is this could be an interdimensional thing, but look at all the other alternatives before you say it is interdimensional. But it could be. There are a number of things in the world that, for all our professed knowledge, we simply don't understand. There could be gateways to other realms, if you like. And I'm not saying there is, but you have to be very careful and begin to explore all the other alternatives before you make that assumption.
Mm-hmm. Well, what would you say let's stop for a minute and talk about this. These islands that appear and then disappear, that are chronicled in very old texts.
Yeah.
If we talk about, conventional science, what's the explanation for these?
For instance, off the coast of Iceland, there are and off Norway, there are a number of islands which are kicked up by volcanic activity. Now, these are simply islands which appear and then they disappear. Rising tides, rising sea levels, things like that can sweep over. I'm told part of the Florida Keys are now disappearing under the sea because of rising sea levels. So maybe in, let's say, about 150 years, somebody can be ringing somebody else and saying, is it true that there were islands which appeared and disappeared back in 2015? And somebody will say, oh, well, that's just an old legend. There could be scientific reasons. There could be refraction, a light refraction, which makes things many miles away appear as if they are just across the sea from you. There are rocks which rise and fall. There are islands which are kicked up by volcanic activity and then are subsumed again by the sea. There are all sorts of explanations, and we have to have a look at those before we say maybe it's another dimension. Now, Cliff, I'm not discounting that there may be other realities which people can sometimes walk into. I don't know. If you look at the book, you will see that in a number of mythologies, there are notions of another world. For instance, among the Egyptians, among the ancient Celts, and that world was not so different from our own. The ancient Celts believed that you could sit in the other world and watch what was going on in this one. And sometimes you could go backwards and forwards between them. So it is an old myth in a number of cultures, so there must be something at the bottom of it.
That's fascinating. Let's talk about the biggest myth in your chapters on Sunken Island.
Yep.
Atlantis, which is a fascination of mine.
I thought we would come to that, Cliff.
Tell us about what you have uncovered on the mythology of Atlantis.
What we know about Atlantis comes from the Romans and the Greeks, from the Mediterranean cultures, and particularly from a philosopher called Plato. Now, Plato located Atlantis beyond, he says, the Pillars of Hercules. Now, the Pillars of Hercules were the Straits of Gibraltar, and Atlantis has given its name to the Atlantic Ocean. But I suspect, and I mention this in the book, of course it could be wrong, but I suspect that what they were talking about was a civilization which was known to them, and that was the Minoan civilization. The Minoan civilization was based around Crete and existed. Crete made war against Athens at the time, but the Minoan civilization flourished and we suspect was destroyed by a massive volcano. If you go today to the island of Santorini, you will see that and if you walk along the beach, you will see that the sand is black. Now that is volcanic. At some point in its history, way back, Santorini simply exploded. And Santorini may well have been one of the centers of the Minoan civilization. Now, there may well have been another civilization which was destroyed, very much so, because the ancient world was an incredibly volatile place, and there were volcanoes erupting and exploding all over the place. You begin to look even to the east as late as the 1800s. You have a volcano like Krakatoa exploding almost as big as an atom bomb. So there may well have been another civilization which was destroyed. Now, what we know about Atlantis was that whenever I was growing up, Atlantis was supposedly a wonderful place, very much advanced, cities of gold. What we know, or what we think we know from the texts, is that Atlantis was not like that. Atlantis was an incredibly warlike nation. It was a seaborne nation because it had a great fleet, apparently. And Plato described it as having a number of harbors, all interlocking. And the interior of the country was serviced by a number of canals. Now, that will once again echo what we were talking about earlier, and the Khmers, or indeed the Egyptians. And that Atlantis made its money, or its wealth, by slave trading. They were slavers. So we're taking away from, and this is what it was saying earlier, we can project all a number of things which we would like about ancient civilizations. Some of the ancient civilizations, while they were advanced, and they may well have been advanced, could also have been an incredibly barbarous and relied on things like slave trade, things like gladiators, things like that, because it was in some old texts, the Atlanteans take away Greeks to fight in their arenas, fight against the creatures in the arena or animals in the arenas, and jump, literally jump across bulls and stuff like that, which was a favorite sport among the Minoans. And you must remember that Atlantis may well be a projection of the Minoan civilization and what the Greeks didn't like about the Minoan civilization. So they described them as traders, slave traders. They described them as barbarous. They described them as cruel and warlike, which is a metaphor for the war between Athens and the Minoan civilization.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, you actually go into a lot of more detail than that, though.
Yep.
You actually bring in Casey, who describes the potential of Yucatan in Central America as being a satellite
absolutely
of Atlantis. But I mean, talk to us more about some of the other references you have, because to my mind, even though the island doesn't exist, or it's a huge continent, you know, because of some tectonic eruption or perhaps a cosmic event where a planetary body disrupted the field of gravity in the Earth and changed it. But I mean, there's great deals of there's other references other than Plato. Tell us a little bit about your research. I think it's
well, we are looking at now whether it's a continent or not. We don't know. It may well simply have been an island. But you had people like Madame Blavatsky, which looked back and saw the Atlanteans as one of the sort of levels of civilization which the Earth had gone through. You have some thinkers, such as Casey, linking the Atlanteans with South America and perhaps even Egypt with the great pyramid-like structures which, for instance, the ancient Aztecs had. And there are a number of ideas that America was originally founded by survivors from Atlantis. That and when the island or the continent or whatever it was sunk, the Atlantean fleet, and remember that I said that Atlanteans were a seaborne people, the Atlantean fleet were at sea and settled on the land. Now, they would need to go a great bit from the Mediterranean, if that's where they were, to get to the shores of America. But there may well have been another island, or it may not have been Santorini. So they may have traveled as far as America and began to build the great pyramid structures of the Aztecs and the ancient Incas.
Hmm. So
there may still, it is said, be some survivors of Atlantis under Mount Shasta, which I think is in California.
North of where I am, yes.
Oh,
yeah.
So you may be sitting... it is said that some of the survivors may well have gone underground. So, Cliff, you may be sitting on Atlantean survivors. Just watch in case somebody comes up from the earth behind
you. It's funny you mentioned Mount Shasta. There's so much activity in that place. I mean, if you're into UFOs, there's UFO sightings there. There's Sasquatch or the Bigfoot sightings there.
Well, you see, it's also supposed to be survivors from Atlantis. And this is started, according to some thinkers, started all this activity you're talking about. The UFOs may be Atlantean ships.
Yeah.
So, but once again, we're looking at projections into what a forgotten civilization may be like.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, you know, Atlantis is, and I was just curious because you do spend a lot of time on this.
Yep.
And you even cover unconventional information, which would be Edgar Cayce.
Yep.
And I found that was interesting. A lot of people won't touch his work because it's so far out. And, of course, he was the sleeping prophet or a psychic of tremendous ability. His ability to determine people's health was phenomenal, so they automatically believe that if he...
A lot of people will not touch his work, but, I mean, I thought, and I make reference to it, and I thought he cannot, he has talked about a bit about Atlantis. Admittedly, some of his theories are rather far out, but you must mention him because he has talked about Atlantis and various things like that.
Yes. Let's talk about a place that I didn't know about. You call it Lyonnais.
Oh, Lyonnais.
Yeah, tell us about that place. Lyonnais, I've never heard of it.
Is an interesting place because we do believe that Lyonnais existed. And we believe that you can still see traces of it today. Now, Lyonnais, for those of your listeners who don't know, was a medieval kingdom which stretched from the very end of Cornwall down into France. Now, you look at a map today, Cliff, and you will see the English Channel between us. Now, many people think is the English Channel has not always been there. That in early medieval times, you could walk all the way from Cornwall to Brittany in France. And the reason for that is they have found, as they went out, the stumps of trees, which suggests now this is under the water, which suggests that there was a forest there. The coast of any country, Britain included, is constantly changing. And if you look at old maps, perhaps as well in America, along the coasts, you will see towns which are not there. Some towns have slid into the sea. And that is because the nature of the coast has changed. Now, what we think has happened is that the nature of the coast between Brittany and Britain changed. And there was a massive flood from the Atlantic Ocean, which cut off France and Cornwall, both of which are Celtic kingdoms. And you have the forest. You also have St. Michael's Mount, which was shows up on old maps actually as a mountain. It is a sort of small island off the coast of the south of England. So you all ancient traditions speak of a country called Leonis, which was ruled over by a number of kings. And if you look in the book, you will find a list of kings, most of whom are medieval, from around about the 6th century. And at some point, that country has been overwhelmed by the sea and has sunken beneath the waves. But it still exists in myth and legend. But we do think that something akin to that existed, and that there were, that beneath the English Channel there are farmlands, and perhaps the ruins of its capital, Caer Ys, which was ruled over by at least four of these kings.
Interesting. And I'm sorry, you said that it is supposedly to have existed during the medieval period?
The medieval period. We have some of the kings carry medieval names, like I'm trying to see here, but they certainly have medieval names. Mainly names from a Welsh tradition, which means that they were, you have things like Tristan, which is possibly from the Welsh Arthurian legend, and maybe have some connection to the Welsh Arthurian legends. So you may have, you have Tristan the Elder, Tristan the Younger, who are named as kings there. And they may come from, or may be connected to, the Arthurian tradition.
Interesting.
So you're looking around the time of Arthur.
Fascinating. Let's come to America and the legend of El Dorado. Now, we know that the Spanish conquistadors were just hungry for anything in gold and destroyed countless temples and sacred sites of the Maya as well as other people to fill their coffers and to ship back to the kings of Spain. But you describe Coronado's travels to find the seven cities of gold, and I want you to tell us a little bit about what you discovered about the legend of gold.
Well, the Spanish were based largely in what is now Mexico, and they were interested in not only in gold, but also expanding the Spanish Empire. Coronado was, of course, governor of New Galicia, which was New Spain. And he had heard, because the Spanish were always interested in old legends, he had heard from a monk called Marcos de Niza of the seven cities of Cibola, which lay away in the north, and which were cities of not only gold, but of not primarily of gold, but of great wealth, because there were gold mines there. So he began to gather together an army to go and have a look at this, because he was a military man. So he's around about the 1560s. He assembles an army and marches north to look for these cities. He doesn't find them. He crosses southern Texas, and he crosses the Great Staked Plains and places like that, until he comes to the country of the Wichitas, when he turns back. Most of his men are wiped out by plague, by hostile Indians, and he didn't see Deniza had led him astray. Now, that did not stop conquistadors looking for various legends, legendary cities which had been set up and were supposedly attached to gold mines, which were then used by the Indians to create wealth. The name El Dorado, of course, does not refer to a city. It refers to a man. He was a man who was supposedly among the Indians, according to the conquistadors, who was completely swathed in gold. He was the Gilded Man. And there was stories about him, even in South America, in parts of the Andes, and near Lake Titicaca, where the Gilded Man was sacrificed. Now, there was a great tradition among many, many ancient peoples, from the Aztecs to the Celts, where old rulers were sacrificed so that they could make way for new rulers. And the Gilded Man was swathed in gold and thrown into the lake. So this became a part of the legend which drew explorers to hunt for El Dorado. He was supposed to live in a great city. Now, this, the story of the legend of El Dorado has persisted. It is, but it is not the only city. For instance, in parts of Uruguay, there is supposedly the city of the Seven Caesars. Now, these were seven Roman nobles who had fled from Rome in early times during civil war in Rome, and had found a great vein of silver somewhere in the Uruguayan hills, and had built a city, there were seven of them, which was Roman. And so there's supposedly there's all sorts of cities. Now, these, the idea of the cities was given a boost when, as I told you, the French explorer walked out of the jungle in Cambodia and found himself in the main street of Angkor Wat, a lost city which nobody knew about. And there are possibly lost cities of various civilizations still existing in the world today. So, but the conquistadors were lured, and you're quite right, Cliff. Spain was engaged in war against England and needed plenty of money. So the idea of gold mines in the hills used by the Indians, and there certainly were gold mines used by the Indians, but that idea fired the Spanish exchequer, if you want to call it that, and sent them looking for gold and wealth in America.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. Your book has a section, and we're getting down to our moments here. I want you to talk to us a little bit about this Arabian place called the City of Pillars, and why you found that it was interesting enough to put in your book.
That is because I put it in because there were a number of people who wrote to me and asked me about something in H.P. Lovecraft, which was Irem, City of the Pillars, which was supposedly the place where Abdul al-Harazad, the mad Arab who wrote the Necronomicon, was supposed to have been, was supposed to have been the city of demons. And they asked me, did that exist? And no, it didn't in the way that we think of it. There are cities, once again, we're talking about vanished cities. There are cities which have vanished for one reason or another. For instance, there was a very famous city which simply disappeared called Ubar. Now, Ubar was a main trading city, and it is on the Arabian Peninsula, and it was on the spice routes. It was it traded in spices, and Ubar suddenly vanished. And after 1000 AD, there is no reference to it at all, even though it is a massive trading city. And I'll tell you what actually happened, because it has now been found. Underneath Ubar was a massive lake, and that was used as the city's water supply. And as they began to use the water table got lower and lower, and the roof of the cavern in which the lake lay, on which Ubar had been built, grew weaker and weaker. And the city simply fell into a hole.
Wow.
Vanished. So, that may be, that became a great mystery, and may be one of the stories which may have suggested the City of the Pillars. Now, in southern Jordan as well, there is a place called Wadi Rum. Now, Wadi Rum was a very famous place. It is in a place, it is north of Aleppo, and is a place called in a place called the Valley of the Moon, and that gives it a sort of romantic air. But it is a massive it rises out of the desert, and the story is that that was an ancient city at one time, built by demons. And the demons were driven out into the desert by King Solomon, who appears in the Bible. God had given Solomon power over what were called the jinn, or the genii, from which we get the word genie. And they had built a massive city out there. Now, that was supposedly the place where the Mukarrabin are known as the ghost priests among the Bedouin, and they are supposedly guardians of ancient knowledge and esoteric knowledge and things like that, as distinct from the Fugara, who are healers. But the ghost priests are the guardians of the ancient traditions, and they say that this is where the jinn built their city, and it is supposedly a very powerful place. There are supposed to be at least seven canisters, metal canisters, hidden there, which detail the history of the world through the eyes of the jinn, or the genies, and that the genies are still there. But this is, so this had formed the basis, for example, of Lovecraft's Irem City of the Pillars, and that's why I included it in the book.
Fascinating. In the time we have left, Bob, what is it that you initially set out to do? You set out to provide your readers with these myths and legends, and then you research them to the point where there are great possibilities that these places actually exist or existed at one time.
Mm-hmm.
But when the book was all done, and now it's a few years gone, what do you still have the same impression, like, this is what I want people to understand, or have you taken a different look at it and think, well, it's up to you, the reader, to decide if it's true or not?
In answer to your question, Cliff, both things. One of the things which all my books, because this is one of a number of books which I've written, and I suppose that one of the, I come back to what I said at the start of the show. One of the reasons why I've written these books is to ask the reader, what does this tell you about yourself? You have a look at the lost lands, the forgotten realms, and what does if you believe that they existed, that's fine. Some of these I do believe exist. For example, we didn't have time to talk about, for example, Prince Madoc, who was a Welsh king who ruled in Alabama in the 1100s. And that, there is good, hard evidence for that.
Alabama, United States?
Alabama, he landed at Mobile Bay. And we do know that he existed because he built a number of castles along several rivers. We do know that he existed because a certain Welsh minister preaching to the Indians round about there overheard them speaking in his native tongue. So and they said that they had learned it from their fathers, who in turn had learned it from white settlers who had arrived there, and they dated it back to 1100. And if you look at some of the castles around places like DeSoto Falls and stuff, they correspond with Carnarvon Castle in Wales. So Prince Madoc, and we do know that Prince Madoc was driven out of Gwynedd around about the mid-1100s, and that he sailed west, which means that he probably finished up in America. So you and you have because I have been contacted by them, by the daughters of Prince Madoc, based in Mobile, Alabama.
That's a new one on me.
Who uphold the traditions of a Welsh prince who who ruled in Alabama.
I'll be darned. Oh, that's a new one.
Century.
That's a new one on me.
You have a look in the book at the kingdom of, or the legend of Prince Madoc.
Wow.
And for me, that is one of the most enduring and sustainable myths. Other myths, you come back and you say, well, why do we want to believe in that? Why do we want to believe that there was a city of gold? Why do we want to believe that there was a terrific civilization which was consumed by the sea? What does that tell us about our aspirations? What does that tell us about the way our civilization is going? And why would we need to believe that? So I'm not saying none of these existed. I think a lot of them did. But we are putting a modern day interpretation on it. So we want to ask what that tells us about ourselves and our own civilization today.
Mm-hmm. So you're basically saying that we should look to the past to understand what our future holds?
You cannot understand where you are going without understanding where you have come from. So, yes, look at the past. Look through, not from an air of superiority and saying, have we done very well for ourselves? But looking back and saying, what can ancient civilizations ancient myth systems, things like that. What can they teach us? What have they to say to us? And maybe our civilization will be the better for it.
Fantastic. In our last couple of minutes, I always ask our authors, and by the way, Bob, this has been a wonderful discussion with you. I always ask where you will be, if any of our audience can hear you speak, if you're in the United States. A lot of our audience is in the UK and in Europe. Do you have any upcoming talks?
I am not long back, actually, from Argentina. We were down for the Dia del Muerto because we were doing. I've also written on zombies and things like that. but that's for another time. You can. I'm taking a wee bit of a break now, but they can get in contact with me on various sites. They can. I'll give you an email address, which you know, drbobcurran@yahoo.co.uk, and you can get in contact with me at any time. I'll talk to whoever.
Well, but you have a blog page, don't you? What is the address? And I'll make sure that I post.
It is done through Career Press. If you look up my blog page, sorry, I forgot to mention that. Yes, if you look up my blog page, you'll also, I think, find me on Facebook.
Yeah. I'll post that there.
If you do. So that would be lovely, Cliff.
I will definitely do that. No, I always typically try to do that. So you're taking a break. You've been traveling.
I have been writing books. I have, between ourselves and your audience, Cliff, I have written almost 50 books.
Oh, my God.
And that's in English. I have more in Korean, Chinese. I'm looking along the bookshelf here. Russian, Polish.
Well, they've been translated, basically, right?
All translated. Some of them translated, some of them new works.
Ah, okay. Wonderful. Yeah. Wonderful.
So there you are. I thought I would. I'm doing a lot of community work at the minute and working with community groups. As I say, Cliff, I'm getting no younger.
Well,
I'm not a young whippersnapper like you, you know.
Well, we're all aging. Your work is fascinating. The book we've been talking about is Lost Lands, Forgotten Realms, Sunken Continents, Vanished Cities, and the Kingdoms That History Misplaced. My guest is Dr. Bob Curran, and it's wonderful talking to you. Real quickly, Ian Daniels did the illustrations in this book. How did you get him to do all these wonderful illustrations?
Ian and I have worked together for a long period of time.
Oh, really? Okay.
If you look at some of the other books which Career Press have brought out, you'll see him doing the illustrations. I approached him through a friend of mine in England. Ian lives, he was living until recently in Hastings, and we got together and I said, would you like to do it? And we worked on, I think it was about something like 10 or 11 books together.
Wow. Okay.
And I still I'm in contact with him, and I'm working with a number of other things. I'm working on comics at the minute.
Well, you have your hands in a lot of stuff. That's fantastic.
I have tentacles in a lot of pies.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. I really appreciate you being on the program.
Cliff, it was a pleasure to speak to you.
So that's Bob Curran, and I hope you enjoyed that. It was a little longer. I wanted to keep it as much as possible. We had a good connection. And I hope you enjoyed that. I'm going to post some photographs that he has sent me based on his research, as well as the Atacama Desert. And that is it for this week. Stay tuned for next week. Each week, I do my best to bring you Earth ancient, startling new discoveries from our planet's distant past, and I hope you had a great time. Thanks.